Thumbtack presents the ins and outs of caring for your home. Out. Indecision. Overthinking. Second-guessing every choice you make. In. Plans and guides that make it easy to get home projects done. Out. Beige on beige on beige. Ugh. In. Knowing what to do, when to do it, and who to hire. Start caring for your home with confidence. Download Thumbtack today.
If you have health insurance, you might be able to see a personal dietitian for $0 out of pocket. Nourish connects you with a dietitian that fits your needs, covered by your insurance. Nourish accepts hundreds of insurance plans, and 94% of patients pay $0 out of pocket. Meet with your dietitian online and message them anytime through the Nourish app. With hundreds of five-star reviews from real patients, you know you're in good hands. Find your dietitian at usenourish.com. That's usenourish.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This season, a new hot deal has arrived at Metro. $25 a line for 4 lines with all the data you need and 4 free Samsung Galaxy A15 5G phones. Getting Metro's best deals is easy. No ID required, no activation fees. Get a new number or keep your own. It's up to you. That's 4 lines for $25 a line plus 4 free phones. Visit a store or go online today. Only at Metro by T-Mobile.
When you join Metro plus tax, for a limited time and subject to change. Max 1 offer per account.
Let me start this conversation about this. I know there are the traditional 4 or 5 of you, because I recognize the numbers, that are going to besiege me with text about Trump and how good he is and everything else. And that's fine. This is America. I'm all for that. But this is a president we've not seen, and I don't know if ever, and we'll talk about that in a second. But to make a football analogy to me, this is like the offense came out with the center and then lined everybody up in a V formation like ducks fly. And the defense did the same. And some people look at this and say, forget the defense. Let's talk about the offense. And some people will look at this and say, well, it's against the rules. You can't do that. Other people will say, no, actually, you can. Some people will look at this and say, this is awful. This is horrible. Other people will say it's brilliant and creative. My own personal theory is President Trump is either crazy like a fox or he's just plain crazy. Those are my thoughts. That's just my opinion. But let's get a more professional opinion on that from Jamie Rowan, Associate Professor of Legal Studies at UMass Amherst and Director of the Center for Justice, Law, and Societies. Good morning, Jamie. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm all right. Let's talk about this president, because some people love him, some people hate him, some people have a wait-and-see attitude, some people are terrified. Just in terms of the context of the presidency, we have not seen a president like this in a long time, or if ever. Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that President Trump is invoking powers that no presidents have ever invoked before, and he's trying to regulate industries in ways that no president has ever regulated before, and he's doing those regulations in ways that directly contradict the Constitution and are absolutely not going to pass judicial scrutiny, but the act of doing that is causing a lot of damage for people.
It, can all of this be kind of discussed in microcosm with what's going on with the guy that they wrongly, I put that in quotation marks because it depends, I guess, on who you ask, to El Salvador and what's going on with the Supreme Court? And if you can, Jamie, give us some context on that so we understand, A, what's going on, and B, the constitutional part of it.
Sure. So there was a man named Abrego Garcia who came to the United States as an undocumented immigrant. And when he was challenged in court about his ability to stay, the court said that the United States is not legally allowed to remove him because removing him specifically to El Salvador could result in torture. Mm-hmm. So undocumented immigrants that come here, claim asylum, and might be tortured if they're forced to return to their countries of origin do not have to go home to their countries of origin. There's legal precedent for that. That's the way it works. So this particular immigrant was here legally, and the United States wasn't allowed to remove him. So the ICE and Immigration and Customs Enforcement arrested him, claimed that he was part of a gang without any evidence, and sent him along with 200 other migrants to a prison in El Salvador. Now, because he was the one person who, there's a clear record, was legally supposed to not be removed, federal courts have said that the executive authority overstepped its powers by making this man essentially disappear into a prison in a foreign country. It made it all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ordered the Trump administration to facilitate his return. It didn't say you have to go get him, because courts can't say that to an executive. That's basically saying go invade a country, for example. Now, what President Trump, in his collaboration with the El Salvadorian government, said is no. We will not be facilitating his return. So we've, again, not really seen a president blatantly say no to the Supreme Court when the Supreme Court is exercising its fundamental right as a, it's a separation of powers issue. The court is able to say that an individual was wrongly detained or, in this case, deported, and the executive is saying no to the court. That is new.
I saw the attorney general parsing words in the Oval Office with facilitate and what facilitate means, and I heard you explain it just now. So I wonder, is this a brilliant move by the Trump administration to circumvent the Supreme Court, or did they just fall into this, or does anybody know?
So the history of the Supreme Court and the executive branch and the legislative branch is actually quite complex, because the Constitution doesn't clarify a lot of the powers that these different branches have. And so in its origins, the judicial branch actually has claimed we don't have jurisdiction sometimes in order to assert authority. And in this case, they said we do have authority over the executive to say that the executive has to do something. The word facilitate is the ambiguous piece. I question whether the Supreme Court could really say anything more than that. But it doesn't really matter what word it used. What matters is that the executive branch isn't facilitating. It's not making an attempt, and it's blatantly saying to the court and to the American public, we don't have to. And I want the listeners to appreciate this from a due process perspective. The Fifth and Sixth Amendments of the Constitution protect all of us, citizens and non-citizens, from the federal government unjustly detaining us without due process. And this federal government is saying, I don't have to follow that.
Let's talk about the gang membership aspect of this. M13, I don't know if he's a member, if he's not. Does anybody know?
No, there's no evidence, none, that he is a member of this gang. In fact, his family, he's a father of three, and there's no connection between him and this gang.
Somebody texted and said the judges said he was part of that, but did any judge say that?
No.
Okay.
But it doesn't matter. First of all, no, and he's legally not supposed to be removed from the United States. And so, again, the judicial branch has said it was supposed to do as well.
You broke up for a little bit. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. I also want to talk about the president saying he wants to imprison U.S. citizens in El Salvador. And if I don't know anything about Abrego Garcia at all, but if he did apply for asylum and then you returned him to El Salvador, in essence, you put him in the hands of the people that I guess he was applying for asylum from, and now they're saying they're not going to send him back. So we'll pick it up. We come back talking to Jamie Rowan, Associate Professor of Legal Studies at UMass Amherst, Director of the Center for Justice, Law, and Societies. And I would ask that you not look at it as a zero-sum game, that you look at it as, okay, wait a minute, let's make sure that somehow I don't get caught up in this spotlight, and then all of a sudden I'm involved in this. 623 traffic now, WWL. Tommy Target, WWL, 627. Quickly back to Jamie Rowan, Associate Professor of Legal Studies at UMass Amherst, Director of the Center for Justice, Law, and Societies. We're talking about, I don't know if it's a constitutional crisis or not with the Supreme Court and Abrego Garcia. What happens now, Jamie?
What's going to happen now? I think there's going to have to be sustained pressure on President Trump and for people who care about these issues of due process. Remember, the Supreme Court found that Abrego Garcia was unlawfully arrested, that the government put forward no evidence that he was a member of a gang, that they just alleged that he was a member of a gang. So I think that with enough pressure that continues, there might be some effort to release him, just him. even though there's 199 individuals that were sent to that prison, and El Salvador and the president have agreed that more people will be sent to this prison, a third country prison that is very, very, very dangerous for individuals.
All right. Now, the president also said yesterday that he'd like to send U.S. citizens who commit violent crimes to prison in El Salvador, telling the president of El Salvador they'd have to build five more places to hold the potential new arrivals. Talk about the constitutionality of that, if you will, please.
Right. So I don't think this is constitutional, and I don't think Donald Trump says things off the top of his head that are constitutional. These are just ideas.
Okay.
He suggests different ideas at various times. There was a report yesterday that he just said on April 1st, maybe we should just take away $9 billion from Harvard, right, to make Harvard change its policies and become more conservative. So I don't think that there's a question at this moment of that happening. It would take a long slide of our due process rights, and I think most judges would prevent that from happening. I do think that people who are not citizens of the United States, though, are facing increased risk of all sorts of things. There was a man yesterday who went to get his citizenship papers in Vermont, and he was there arrested for his involvement in campus activism. And regardless of what you think of the speech, one of the biggest concerns in U.S. history has always been the federal government restricting speech that doesn't incite violence, right? And there's again, specific things you should not do. But otherwise, stating a political belief is core to our Constitution, and people who are not citizens are now facing terrible, terrible consequences for political speech the president doesn't like.
Are we bordering on extraordinary rendition? Is that what they called it during 9/11?
They did, and I think of it like that, actually. The only way that you can think it's different is that many of the people who the United States government captured in the 2001 period were outside the country and then sent to third countries.
Thank you, Jamie. Appreciate your time. Insight as always, Jamie Rauman, Associate Professor of Legal Studies at UMass Amherst, Director of the Center for Justice, Law, and Societies. I'm looking at the text line from a few people, and look, I understand what you're saying. My only concern is that it's kind of like the popular table in the cafeteria in high school, right, with the cool kids. It's all good if you're sitting at the table with the cool kids, but then all of a sudden when you find yourself, the cool kids decide you're not cool anymore and you're not welcome at that table, and then you become the target, then all of a sudden you're thinking, this sucks. We'll take a break, come back. Speaking of sucking, talk about the procession underway and what can be done with the insurance crisis and more right now. Time for WWL First News. 6:45, quarter till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly to State Senate President and Senator Cameron Henry. How you doing, Cameron?
Morning, buddy. How are you?
I'm all right. Look, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I do think it's interesting about the process of this. As the Senate president, when you're in session, what does your day look like? What happens? People come and meet with you. They bring you bills. You negotiate. Tell me, the people, how that works.
Yes to everything.
Okay.
I usually start off with phone calls kind of just like this. When I wake up in the morning, and I try to get to the Capitol around 8 or 8:30, and I start meetings either in 15-minute or 30-minute intervals until we go on the floor. And it's everything from members that have questions about bills to a strategy they want to use, issues they have with staff, issues they have with another member's bills, problems back home, issue with an agency, maybe Department of Transportation, if you can help with that. They want to, you know, have a conversation with the governor and figure out what the best strategy is to go work an angle that they're trying to work through something. Whatever you could think of, somebody's kid needs help getting into college, whatever you can imagine, it all comes to my desk.
Jesuit graduate
for the world.
LSU degree in political science, MBA from Tulane in finance. And you work with Steve Scalise. So you are a policy guy, but yet you got to massage some personalities, I guess, right? Part of what you're doing is salesmanship?
The majority of it is relationship-driven.
Okay.
Absolute, overwhelming majority of my job deals with relationships.
And putting this one with that one, say, well, maybe he didn't mean this, and sometimes it gets personal, I guess. You got to work that out, too. I'm just curious.
Yeah. I mean, you're trying to manage the day. You know, eliminate as many problems as you can, and don't create any more for tomorrow.
Good. There you go. Because everybody thinks they're right. I don't think people realize that, but everybody thinks they're right, and that's what you got to go through. Let's talk about the governor's Gator plan and your thoughts on that.
Well, the Gator plan was a switchover from the voucher program. Now, the voucher program that the state ran was arguably, by their own admission, one of the worst-run voucher programs in the country. So they switched it to the Gator program, which is going to provide state money to send children to private and parochial schools.
But wait, how is that different than the voucher program, Cameron?
They're going to go to any school they want. Okay. They will literally be able to write the parent a check, and they'll be able to go to whatever school they want.
Gotcha.
The issue that we're having, because when we originally did it, we were just going to use the money previously allocated for the voucher program, which was for about 6,000 students, $50 million. They want to increase that to $94 million. What everyone fails to talk about, and which we'll talk about next week when I meet with them at a meeting in Baton Rouge, is how many schools are available, how many seats are available in each school to take these children, right? So I there's no point in me giving any program money if they can't actually utilize it. So they did what I expected them to do. They opened up enrollment to where they could get a whole bunch of kids to sign up to put pressure on members to fund it, but without knowing how many seats are available. So once, you know, like everything else you do in Baton Rouge, we're going to slow that down a little bit. We're going to figure out how many seats are available, physically chairs are available, whatever school you can think of right now. Are they willing to take to accept the children? That's one step. The second step is if it's a child that's currently at a public school, they might be getting some type of services, speech therapy, whatever it might be. When they move to that new school, whatever school it may be, will those services be able to go with them? we need to work through that. You know, another issue is on transportation. If they move to another school, does that system now need to provide transportation for that child to go, used to go to one school, now has to go to another? So it's not just as easy as, oh, we're just going to write the parent a check and hope they can find a place to stay. Hope they can find a place to go to school. We're going to approach it. We're going to learn from the mistakes. Obviously, they made some with the voucher program. So we're going to get the program up and running, but we're going to do it in a very methodical way that makes sure that we're spending taxpayer money wisely.
As far as the structuring of this and the way it changes year to year, this is eventually going to wind up just being a subsidy to people that already have their kids in private schools, or am I wrong?
Well, in other states, it has turned into that, which has ballooned the fiscal note to $800 or $900 million. Now, currently, there's people listening to your radio show whose parents or mother or father or guardian works their tail off to send their child to private school or parochial school. Right. And now what we want to do is from a state perspective, is we want to give another group of parents a subsidy to send their kid to the same exact school, which some people, specifically in my and Jefferson Parish, have a little concerned about that, saying I'm working twice as hard to send my kid there. Now I'm going to subsidize public education. And now I'm also going to subsidize someone going to a parochial school or a private school. We're muddying the water with it all. So like everything else I do in Baton Rouge, we're going to have one more meeting over the contract. Remember, this program isn't run by the Department of Education. It's run by an outside group that gets a percentage of the money that we allocate to each child. They get a percentage of that. They charge a fee of $143 per child. So this is a moneymaker for someone. And we have to run that down for a little bit longer before we move forward with any type of contracts that do that.
So it would be accurate to say you have serious concerns with the way it's structured now and that you just want to press pause on all of this and kind of go through it?
Yeah, and it's not unrealistic. We're not going to allocate $94 million to someone who can only spend $20 million. You know, that other $74 million can go a long way in other programs in the state, infrastructure, deferred maintenance for higher ed, a bunch of different areas, water sector, all kind of areas. So that's all. I mean, people get excited up here and want to come up here and ask for all the money in the world. It's our job to slow it down and make sure we're using it the right way.
So you're hearing from people, and we got to take a break here, but you're hearing from people on all sides of this issue, right?
Of course, yeah, because look, somebody has a child in a failing school and they want to move them. I can appreciate that. I can appreciate that every school is not meant for every child. And if you have multiple children or family, different schools work for them. And you don't want to deny a child that. But what you also don't want to do is make it a moneymaker for an outside company, when I don't see why the Department of Education can't run this program, since we're starting off with 6,000 kids in the voucher program and they already know who those kids are. So
all right, let me
just got to slow it down a little bit.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to State Senate President Cameron Henry. We're going to drill down on insurance when we come back, because Give me some hope, Cameron, because I my name is Thomas, and I'm appropriately named because I doubt I'm going to see anything that changes on insurance. But we'll see. 652, 8 till 8, traffic now, WWL. All right, quickly back to Cameron Henry, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Cameron Henry, our friend, Louisiana State Senator, Senate President. Cameron, my name's Thomas. I'm doubtful by nature. My parents picked the right name. Tell me about insurance, either auto or home, and give me some kind of hope that anything's going to change.
Well, I mean, if you talk to the insurance companies, no matter what we pass, they can't guarantee rates are going to be low whatever. So we'll put that out there right across the board. That doesn't mean we're not going to do anything up here. What we're trying to balance is the insurance companies really want to make it very difficult for policyholders to hold them accountable for anything. And from the other side of it, we also want to make sure that we don't run amok with frivolous lawsuits and so forth. So we're trying to find that balance. I think if you listen to the governor's speech yesterday, we're trying to find that balance in there. All of us, especially in your listening area, have had issues with hurricanes and floods and whatever it might be, and we've had issues with adjusters, insurance companies. We want to have some authority to hold them accountable when they deny our claim or tell us that they're going to give us $1,000 for a $10,000 roof or whatever it might be. We need to have some way to push back on them, and we can't cede all that authority back to the insurance companies on the hopes that they lower our rate. That's just not going to work. And it relates to auto. I pay auto insurance for 4 drivers. Mm. I get destroyed by it just like everybody else. But the same thing, if you're actually legitimately injured in a wreck, well, then you probably should be taken care of. That's mm-hmm. common sense. It's the frivolous small ones that we have to work through. But we're going to get there, but I can't guarantee lower rates because the insurance company will tell you no matter what you do, they can't guarantee anything other than the status quo at this point. But we're going to work towards putting more pressure on not only on the insurance industries, but I think we're going to work with the insurance commissioner to give him a little bit more authority as well to see if he can help solve some of these problems for us.
Cameron, you're smarter than I am, but I'll tell you what, I think when you said common sense, that's where you delved into territory that was troublesome. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank
Have
you.
Have a good day. Louisiana State Bye-bye. Senate President Cameron Henry will take a break. Come back. Talk to Representative Delisha Boyd about some of the bills she's proposed, one that addresses hazing at college. Then we'll talk to Ben Riggs with Real Reform Louisiana about insurance crisis. Tommy Tucker back in a flash. False start on the host, 5 yards. We'll replay the down. Highs today of 80. Right now it's nice, beautiful spring morning, 65 degrees. And it's going to go up. A little cool front's coming through. Peyton Malone saying just a 5% chance for showers today, which you don't hear of often. Highs of 76 today, just beautiful sunshine. 81 on Thursday, 84 on Friday. Good Friday. A lot of people have an Easter crawfish boils and so forth. Then Saturday, Holy Saturday, highs of 84. And then Easter Sunday, highs of 83 and cloudy. So it should be okay to be outside, maybe a little bit warm. Delisha Boyd joins us now, Louisiana State Representative, to talk about the session and some of the bills she's filed. Good morning, Representative. How are you?
I'm wonderful, thank you. How are you?
I'm okay. Tell me how you go about when it comes to, first of all, is this your first term or not?
No.
Every morning brings a fresh new energy. And no matter what the day holds, we come to the Today Show for all of it.
We get the best start to the day because we start it together.
Watch the Today Show weekdays at 7 a.m. on NBC.
This is my now third regular session.
Third regular session. I'm sorry. I should have looked that up, but I didn't. Tell me what goes into, I guess, the off season. We always talk about it, you know, sports in the off season. For a legislator, what goes into your off season when it comes to priorities and determining what it is, what legislation you'd like to file, and you hear from constituents? I'm always like to take a peek behind the curtain and see what goes on there.
For me, it's mostly community work. That's what I was doing before I was elected. So I generally try to meet with my community, meet different organizations in my community, and I decide to have bills drafted mm-hmm. based on need. So this session, I actually had drafted about 15. I had to pick 5 from the 15 because we're in a fiscal session.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones I decided on were things that were of immediate importance to my community. One is the
Hang on one second. Before we get to that, I just want to get to when it comes mm-hmm. to, because people want to know, and I do, in general, not just you, but in general, when it comes to drafting a bill, who puts all that together? Do you write that, or who do the legislators write that? Who writes that?
we have staff that's made up of attorneys, very smart, wise attorneys. And you can literally call them with what you're thinking, and they find the legal way to draft it so that if it goes into law, everything is legal about it.
Do you share a staff? Do all legislators share a staff, or each legislator has a staff?
In-house, everybody shares staff based on committee.
I got you. Okay, I'm just curious about that. Let's talk about your legislation, Representative.
Okay, so at the top of my bill is the anti-hazing. We lost a young man not even 3 months ago with regard to hazing off campus.
Caleb Wilson.
Yes, Caleb Wilson. It's called, referred to as the Caleb Wilson Act. This is just to take it a step further. I think most universities have a policy where you read a pamphlet and sign off, or one seminar during orientation. This will include a mandatory class that will be 1 credit hour towards your graduation, but it is mandatory for all incoming freshmen, and also for those who are part of any Greek letter organization, the band, any sporting team will also have to take the class within the next 2 semesters.
Is that college or high school or both?
College.
College, okay.
College and universities.
Are you surprised that what shocked me about the Caleb Wilson tragedy is that with so much that has been made of hazing in the last, 10, 15, maybe even 20 years, that this still goes on?
Well, you know, honestly, I guess you and I both are from the same camp. I thought really had died off. I was in college in the 80s, mm-hmm. where I think it was really bad, and I had not heard of recent hazing in recent years. And then I was shocked to learn that there's hazing with the bands and the sporting teams at some schools. It really was eye-opening for me, which is why I think the class will help kids who want to pledge understand you don't have to allow yourself to be hazed to join any organization. But also, like, the young people who are doing hazing, mm-hmm. I don't know if they are aware of that now hazing with bodily harm is a felony offense. So we need to enlighten everybody full circle on what hazing is and the repercussions of hazing.
And that's what your bill does, right?
Yes.
Yeah, because that's if they don't know that there are penalties, then the penalty's not going to serve as a deterrent, and that's only common sense.
Absolutely. And just to show you what I mean by that, so my bill was drafted maybe 3 weeks ago, and then this past week we had Tulane University to suspend two of their fraternities. And I was speaking with someone, and they were like, how could they do this in the wake of Caleb Wilson? I said, they probably don't know. I know that seems strange with the information to AIDS being what it is, but these kids on campus, they don't watch regular TV or news outlets. They watch Hulu and Netflix. Mm-hmm. And Baton Rouge, although to us it seems around the corner, it is very possible that those kids on Tulane's campus had no idea what happened in Baton Rouge.
You know, as crazy as this sounds, it seems like there could be some kind of low-tech reminder as well, like just signage around the universities as, remember, hazing is a criminal offense, maybe?
Yes, and that's low-hanging fruit. That's actually a great idea.
Thank you. We'll take a break, pick it up. We come back talking to Delisha Boyd, you know, top of mind kind of stuff. Delisha Boyd, Louisiana State Representative. We'll talk about some of the other bills that she's proposed for the session that's underway when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. 7:25, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Legislative session is underway, and we're joined by Delisha Boyd, Representative, Louisiana. Louisiana State Representative Delisha Boyd. I'll get it out. Representative, somebody texted in and said, remember, back when I was in college, we didn't care much about breaking the rules, just saying. And that goes to the nature of your bill, which is, well, maybe if you realize that there are criminal penalties for your behavior, then maybe you would care a lot more about breaking the rules, right?
Absolutely. At the very least, it would be a deterrent, and we're counting on that. And believe it or not, an 18-year-old who's had their eyes set on pledging any fraternity or playing in any band, they are most likely thinking this is what I have to endure to make these teams. And that's simply not the truth. So we want to make sure that both sides are educated because they are in school for a purpose, for a brighter future. And there is no brighter future if someone ends up dead or going to jail. So they need to be aware of a full round circle on what's at stake. And this is not an elective. This will be a mandatory class.
And along those lines, you know, I don't mean to bring you into this, but we're going to talk about Kyron Lacy and mental health later. But this young man made a terrible decision driving, which led, I guess, to a confluence of events that eventually led to his death. Teenagers and young people make bad decisions sometimes. That's why if you can put it in front of them and remind them of the consequences of their actions as often as you can, you can't go wrong. What else do you have proposed, Representative?
That you just spoke about Kyron Lacy. I did a mental health symposium last summer with Congressman Troy Carter that he hosted, and I was shocked to find out that school faculty, staff, counselors are not allowed to call parents and give them any information that could be medically, because the kids are considered adults at 18. So this particular bill will provide a waiver to be signed where the family can be contacted in the mental health crisis. Because sometimes if you catch early enough, something could be done. We had a young girl last week, 7 days yesterday, that committed suicide at Xavier University. And then we had Kyron, who passed away over the weekend. And apparently they had just been displaying personality changes and the stress and the depression and anxiety. We want to try to get these kids help as soon as possible, because the issue with a 18-year-old, a 19-year-old, or even a 22-year-old, 23-year-old is they don't understand you got to keep getting up and tomorrow will get better. Yep. What they see is what's right in front of them, and that it seems permanent in their eyes. They can't find any way out because they haven't had enough life experiences. So we can help the schools connect with the parents. My hope is it will head off some of this mental health crisis that we're suffering since COVID, especially.
And Representative, you talked about being in college in the 80s, and I graduated in 88. It's not the same. It's not the same world that we lived in then. And for people that are not empathetic or sympathetic and say, well, you know, we all have challenges, I don't think people realize the changes. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, but not just that. I think our upbringing was quite different than what the kids are experiencing now. I shielded my daughter, whether it was intentional or not, in my effort to try to make life better for her than what I had.
Me too, same thing. Go ahead.
Yeah, I sheltered her from a lot of things. So the things that I was able to endure from the lane that I traveled is not the same for my daughter, and it's not the same for this generation. So then we now need to make sure that they understand, keep moving, keep getting up. Prayer works, right? But you also sometimes need help of a mental health specialist.
One other bill that you have proposed, Representative?
Yes, I am. I also proposed the exception to a rape and incest to the abortion laws for children under 16. You know, Tommy, kids, again, because it's a different world, whether it's the food or whatever it is, some of these kids are getting their cycles as young as 9 years old. The idea of a 9-year-old being forced to carry her abuser's child to term. I have one kid, because my pregnancy was so hard at 23, so I can't even begin to imagine the 9-year-old. But I want to just place that decision in the family.
But you know that's more of a protest, right? Because you know that has no chance of passing?
Well, it's not a protest. It's a personal journey for me.
Let's put it that way. Okay. I didn't mean that in a demeaning way at all, Representative. I hope you know that.
I didn't take it that way. But, I have not, since I presented this bill first in 2022, it is my journey. I'm a product of a 15-year-old. My sperm donor was 28. And what I do know is, in 68, there was no choice, but my mother and what she endured, she did not survive that. She was dead before she was 30 years old. And she didn't have a choice in 68. That's not to say she would have chosen to do something about it. I just think that is a decision that should be within the family and not in political people's hands.
Yep. Thank you, Representative. Yep. I appreciate your time. I do. I hope we talk to you again. Delisha Boyd, Louisiana State Representative. When we come back, talk to Ben Riggs, Executive Director of Real Reform Louisiana, about what would it really take to change insurance rates in Louisiana, either on the home side of it or the car side of it, I'd ask you to text the Open Heart Jeweler Talking text line. Don't text and drive. Text, message, and data rates apply, 504-260-1870. What are your realistic expectations about insurance reform after this session? What's going to be different between now and then? Right now, time for WWL First News. 7:45, quarter till 8. I'm getting some interesting texts about my $35 pizza, which I'll address after the news, so you can continue to text in if $35 is normal for a pizza or not, 504-260-1870. Open Heart Jeweler Talking text line, text, message, and data rates may apply. Please don't ever text and drive. Ben Riggs joins us now, Executive Director of Real Reform Louisiana, to talk about the insurance problems in Louisiana and the session. Good morning, Ben. How are you?
Morning. Sounds like we need to be pushing for pizza reform, $35.
Yeah. Does that seem high to you or not? Because, again, I was saying, I don't know if you heard or not.
I'm just, look, I love pizza. I'll pay for food. It better be a good pizza. That's all I'm going to say. Can't be your standard pizza.
And I live in an insular world. I eat brown rice. I eat vegetables. I eat chicken breasts. It's just the way I eat, and I've trained myself to eat that. And I decided to splurge and get a pizza, a large pizza, and that just seemed kind of high to me. But let's talk about insurance rates, speaking of high.
Sure.
Have you heard anything so far? And I keep saying this. My parents named me Thomas, and rightfully so, because I am extremely doubtful of everything. Give me some hope, Ben, that something between now and the end of the session is going to change so we see any substantial reduction in either homeowner or auto insurance rates.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest with you. The only thing that I really hear that I think has the potential to lower rates is there's a bill out there. I'll dial that back. Significantly lower rates is there's a bill out there that would provide the commissioner with more authority to reject excessive rates. Upon coming into office, one of the first things Commissioner Temple did was he got rid of the previous commissioner's desk rule, which capped the amount of profit that insurers could build into rates they filed with the state. He got rid of that. And Louisiana law explicitly says...
Wait, slow down a little bit. Slow down a little bit. Jim Donilon had what in place?
He had a desk rule. So that's like an internal rule set in the commissioner's office.
Mm-hmm.
Where he would cap the amount of profit that an insurance company could put into a rate filing that they filed with the state.
Mm-hmm.
Commissioner Temple got rid of that.
So tell me what that looks like. In other words, they apply for a rate increase and they say what?
So it's my understanding that the rate, the profit cap for Commissioner Temple, for Commissioner Donilon was like around 8%. Commissioner Temple got rid of that. So
you're talking about like a rate of rate. I don't mean to get too lost here in the weeds, but that's where, again, Ben, playing golf for money, that's where most of the cheating goes on, is in the weeds. So when you say 8%, that means like a rate of return almost?
Profit. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yes, 100%. So, like, the idea is that you get rid of that, and then you're building out rate filings that are based on the risk you're insuring.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that enables you to put an awful, awful, awful high profit factor into the rate filing. Well, Louisiana law explicitly says, and I'm going to read it verbatim, not even characterize it, but just word for word. No rate in a competitive market shall be considered excessive. So Louisiana law doesn't give the commissioner authority to reject a rate purely on the basis of it being excessive, which in the law is defined as a rate that would return an exceedingly high profit for the insurer.
But wait, Ben, so, I hate to jump in here, but you're talking about excessive, exceedingly high. Those are all very subjective terms, are they not? I mean, what's extremely high or excessive to you may not be the same to me.
Are you arguing we ain't paying excessive rates in Louisiana?
No, I am, but I'm just saying, how do you define it? It's like pornography. I know it when I see it, but it's hard to define, as the Supreme Court said. I'm just saying, if you're going to come up with laws and codify something, it seems like it has to be more than that, right? Or not?
Well, that's not how Louisiana law is written. Like this the way that this bill that's in the session right now is proposed is it takes, so the commissioner can currently reject something for being inadequate. And that's important because we don't want insurance companies to become insolvent. And he can reject something for being discriminatory. And he can reject something for being actuarially unjustified, where the math just doesn't add up in the rate filing. The bill in the that's before this legislature right now, which is there's one by Senator Luno, there's another by Representative Robbie Carter. What it would effectively do is just include excessive rates in with the other groupings of errors that the commissioner can reject. And this is something that most commissioners in most states have.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that consumer protection, and I could see where that would not just be something that where an actual excessive rate gets, rejected, sent back to the insurance company, but it could also be a thing that's a deterrent to insurers where they don't feel like they can just file anything and get it implemented. And then the other one that I've actually talked about for a long time, which I think will have a huge impact, is there's one up, and Governor Landry has publicly backed both of these. There's one up that would prohibit the use of credit scores in rate making.
And let me take a break and pick it up right there when we come back. All right, man, because we had to take a break. And no disrespect to you, and this is complicated stuff. And I think a lot of people,
this is
not a reflection on you, are hearing Charlie Brown's teacher here because they're saying, well, you know, when it comes to profit with all the divisions and subdivisions, how do you define profit? The actuarial part I get. But, we got to talk about tort reform, I guess, at some point. We'll talk about credit ratings and insurance rates when we come back. Ben Riggs, Executive Director of Real Reform Louisiana, 9 till 8, Traffic, WWL. 7:57, 3 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Ben Riggs, our guest, Executive Director of Real Reform Louisiana. When the governor gave his speech, one of the rare moments when the Democrats stood up, some House Democrats stood up, is when he mentioned credit scores being used to determine your insurance rates. Ben, the floor is yours.
Yeah, I think credit scores are a way that insurance companies drive up their rates. And the truth is that we've seen examples of people with DWIs and good credit paying less for auto insurance in Louisiana than people with safe driving records and poor credit. It's just something that shouldn't be used to set rates, and we absolutely support that provision and believe that it could potentially lower rates significantly.
How does that compare and contrast with other states?
There are a number of states that prohibit the use of credit scores. I think that when you look at Louisiana, we outpace everybody for the most part on rates, with the exception of Florida. And sadly, it feels like we're kind of going in the direction of Florida with a lot of proposals that's before the legislature this time. And if you look at the insurance crisis in Florida, they passed tort reform a few years ago, and they're having buyer's remorse for it now, and they're starting to undo those provisions because they've had a devastating effect on the people of Florida.
Ben, you know, you mentioned DWIs, and while we talk about actuarial this and profit that and soft tissue damage, what role does that play in DWIs in Louisiana as opposed to other states? Is it a lot higher here or not? Because people always point to drive-through daiquiri shops, et cetera.
Yeah, I think we need to address the way that we police our streets, make our infrastructure safer, make our roads safer. But the truth is, like, the tort reform measures, we've been talking about them for decades. They've never worked. They've never lowered rates, and they're not going to lower rates this time.
And I guess you'd have to go back and see if the numbers hold up, how many of these awards or settlements, whatever you want to call them, are related to accidents that are initially involved, that where alcohol initially played a factor, right? Has anybody studied that, do you know?
Yeah, I don't know the answer as far as like how much like jury verdicts and alcohol related incidents intertwine.
Be interesting to look into it though, to see, because if it's cause and effect. Thank you, Ben. Appreciate your time. We'll talk about this big settlement with Dane Cialino and a Chevron case and oil field damages. It is 8:16. Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by our friend Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola. Good morning, Dane. How are you?
Just fine, Tommy. Morning to you.
Enjoying the spring weather, are you?
Oh, who is it?
Are you a golfer or not?
No, okay. No, it's too frustrating. I just gave it up.
It is. It is. It is very, very, very. Mark Twain said it's a good walk spoiled, and he was right. Let's talk about this verdict. And in doing a little bit of research on this, I thought initially this was a bench trial, and I realized that Judge Michael Clement just presided over it. It was a jury trial. But I wanted to ask you, not to get too far into the weeds here, but did the Chevron verdict going way back allow this to be, ironically, a jury trial?
Well, I mean, in most civil cases, if they reach
Chevron
the
doctrine
amount in controversy.
Is what I meant to say. Chevron doctrine.
No, the Chevron doctrine really didn't have anything to do with it. That's kind of a statutory interpretation decision for the United States Supreme Court. In this case, Chevron was found to be liable for nearly $750 million, but it doesn't have anything to do with the U.S. Supreme Court's case.
All right, I just wanted to make sure I wasn't conflating stuff, which I was, and that's why a little bit of damage is a dangerous thing. So knowledge, rather, is a dangerous thing. So basically, this comes down to a balance between, well, maybe you, why don't you tell us what it comes down to, Dane, historically in the context of oil companies and providing jobs in Louisiana and fixing the mess that they make, but and then not fixing it, or take me through all of this, please.
Yeah, it depends on who you talk to, what people think about this verdict. Of course, the plaintiffs in the case, in this case, Plaquemines Parish, and there are some 42 other cases just like it that are in line to be tried by, on behalf of parishes and municipalities. The argument is that these oil companies made a mess. They didn't clean it up. And this verdict is just what is due to the citizens of Louisiana for the land loss mostly caused by these oil companies digging canals that cause freshwater intrusion and the erosion of marshland. They left behind equipment and slop that needs to be cleaned up, and that costs money, and the citizens shouldn't pay for it, but the oil companies who made the mess should do that. And that's what the plaintiff said, and they were supported in this, which was something very significant, according to all who were involved in this case. And unusual is that the state of Louisiana essentially supported the plaintiff's case here. And that support from the attorney general and the governor's office, in the view of some people, made all the difference and resulted in this nearly $750 million verdict that, once interest and attorney's fees is added to it, is going to be well in excess of $1 billion. On the other hand, if you listen to organizations like Lobby, the Louisiana Association of Business and Industry, the American Tort Organizations, say this is yet another example of why Louisiana is a judicial hellhole, that we have jury jackpot justice here, and this land loss was caused by, among other things, global warming and the environment, and is not solely can't solely be laid at the feet of oil companies. And there's a big appellate issue that the defendants are going to raise. That is, they are being held liable under, if you believe them, under a statute that was came into effect in 1980 that didn't apply to operations, oil and gas operations that predated the statute, and therefore that retroactive application to them is unfair and should be the basis for reversing this verdict on appeal.
Ironically, they're saying global warming, but the reason there would be global warming would be because of the fossil fuels that they were producing?
Yeah, there have been some tremendous lawsuits, huge litigations that have been filed trying to blame global warming on oil companies that have not been successful. But this is a smaller version of that, saying that the canals cut by the oil companies have caused coastal erosion, and that coastal erosion needs to be paid for by the oil companies. It's not solely caused by global warming and rising sea levels.
But Chevron said that it was global warming that caused it, admitting that global warming was happening, or not?
Well, I mean, they did. That was part of their argument on causation, is that climate change is partly responsible for the loss of wetlands.
You see where I'm headed with that, and I'm just wondering, does that put them in a bad spot going forward?
Well, no, because those lawsuits just were doomed from the start, trying to blame global warming on a handful of energy companies. Those lawsuits haven't gone anywhere, and I don't think Chevron was concerned about making arguments in this case that would come back to bite them in those other cases. So what Chevron is really hoping is that the legal errors, according to Chevron's lawyers, that caused these jurors to reach this verdict are going to be reversed on appeal. And the retroactive application of that 1980 law is one of the principal issues that the courts of appeal and ultimately the Louisiana Supreme Court are going to have to deal with over the next 2 or 3 years.
Well, let me take a break. We'll pick it up here. We'll come back about what happens from here. Talking to Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola. Two sides of this. People that work in the oil industry are saying this could lead to, and lobby, LABI, as Dane said, saying it could inhibit future oil production in Louisiana. Others, I think, saying that, well, the days of that are, for the most part, over with, and now it's time for the oil companies to clean up and for the municipalities to collect. 822 traffic now, WWL. 828 Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back with Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, talking about, in a way, it kind of flew under the radar, but it is a big deal. Chevron liable for $745 million in damages, but it might be more than that because there's still some computation to be done, Dane?
Absolutely. Interest is going to have to be added to that, an attorney's fee award. So it's easily going to go over $1 billion. This case has been pending since 2012. The lawyers have been working on it and financing it for all those years. So it's gonna grow.
So a lot of money on both sides is into this already, right? Chevron's not gonna get any of that back. They're looking to limit the loss at this point, I guess. The attorneys got a lot of work and a lot of time and money into this already on the plaintiff side. So ultimately, does Chevron settle here and cut their losses? Does it go to the Supreme Court, and then what's CPRA going to get, because the lawyers got to get paid for the time they have into this? How do you go about solving all of that, King Solomon?
Yeah, that's a lot of difficult poker decisions that Chevron's got ahead of it at this point. Chevron, of course, has got to play the long game on this, and there are 42 other lawsuits, and Chevron no doubt is the target in many of those. Mm-hmm. Chevron, of course, acquired Texaco some years ago, and Texaco had a lot of oil and gas operations in the Louisiana Marsh. So Chevron can't afford just to bail on this case and settle it, although it's going to be part of their thought process. They've got to think about the long game and try to get some good law made on appeal about the retroactivity of the 1980 statute that was a large basis for the plaintiff's award.
Dane, you mentioned earlier that golf was frustrating. Just real quick, which is more frustrating, golf or me thinking that I have a brilliant legal mind?
You're really putting me on the spot there, Tommy.
Thank you, Dane. Appreciate it.
No,
we'll talk to you next time. Thank you, Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, 8:30 time for WL First News. 828 Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back with Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, talking about, in a way, it kind of flew under the radar, but it is a big deal. Chevron liable for $745 million in damages, but it might be more than that because there's still some computation to be done, Dane?
Absolutely. Interest is going to have to be added to that, an attorney's fee award. So it's easily going to go over $1 billion. This case has been pending since 2012. The lawyers have been working on it and financing it for all those years. So, it's going to grow.
So a lot of money on both sides is into this already, right? Chevron's not going to get any of that back. They're looking to limit the loss at this point, I guess. The attorneys got a lot of work and a lot of time and money into this already on the plaintiff side. So ultimately, does Chevron settle here and cut their losses? Does it go to the Supreme Court? And then what's CPRA going to get, because the lawyers got to get paid for the time they have into this. How do you go about solving all of that, King Solomon?
Yeah, that's a lot of difficult poker decisions that Chevron's got ahead of it at this point. Chevron, of course, has got to play the long game on this, and there are 42 other lawsuits, and Chevron, no doubt, is the target in many of those. Mm-hmm. Chevron, of course, acquired Texaco some years ago, and Texaco had a lot of oil and gas operations in the Louisiana Marsh. So Chevron can't afford just to bail on this case and settle it. Although it's going to be part of their thought process, they've got to think about the long game and try to get some good law made on appeal about the retroactivity of the 1980 statute that was a large basis for the plaintiff's award.
Dane, you mentioned earlier that golf was frustrating. Just real quick, which is more frustrating, golf or me thinking that I have a brilliant legal mind?
You really put me on the spot there, Tommy.
Thank you, Dane. Appreciate it.
No,
we'll talk to you next time. Thank you, Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, 8:30 time for WL First News. 8:45, quarter till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Joe Geruso, New Orleans City Council member. How you doing, Joe? Good, me too.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, you had me muted?
No, I think it switched over. I heard the ding come on, so I don't know what happened there.
Was your seatbelt fastened?
I'm in my office, so I'm not even driving now.
Even more important to have your seatbelt fastened over there. Let's talk about, first of all, let me get to this, because look, I have an election every morning, right? And people text in questions, and every time you come on, somebody texts in about restoring West End to vibrant commerce. Growth is the solution to our problems. Every time you come on, this person texts about West End. They are constituents, so let me ask you about West End. Do you know anything about the development of West End?
We actually had a couple of meetings about this maybe about a month ago, one in Jefferson Parish, one in Orleans. And there were a small group of people who want to keep it as it is and didn't want anything to change. But it really seemed like the majority of people were more interested about what, and I will use this term, responsible development look like. Mm-hmm. And like every project, I think people are concerned about traffic, noise, parking. That always goes with the territory. At the same time, I think everybody remembers what West End was and was there and wants there to be something there. So we're working towards that.
So what is it now? I haven't been out there in forever. Is it just an overgrown parking lot or what?
They're actually, I think, they're leasing part of the land for people who have construction, I think, out there. Mm-hmm. So there's actually some materials on the ground there at that point right now. I actually think that the city or municipal yacht harbor is making money because they're actually charging people for it, for the lay down yard that's there. But look, I mean, the bottom line has been much of the yacht harbor has been restored. Parts of around that area have been restored, and we've been talking about this for close to a decade, so it'd be nice to see if we can move this forward.
I was watching something, just flipping around a TV, and one of these WYES specials about New Orleans in the 50s, and they had some shots of West End, and it really was something. Now, I wasn't around the 50s, but I can remember growing up and my parents taking me out there to Fitzgerald's and everything else. You think that's ever likely to return?
Well, I don't know if it'll be on that scale. And look, Tommy, I remember Fitzgerald's and Brunings as a kid, too.
Oh,
I was a little too young for the Jaeger scene in the early and mid-80s. But we want something out there. I don't know that it'll be as big just because the footprint is smaller. But are we looking at what makes sense? What can the market allow? What do residents want? Yes, that's what the goal is. And look, it's exciting for us, too, because I think a number of us feel as though one of our most underutilized resources are our waterways. And there's lots of other cities that use that for their economic development. And again, this isn't a new approach. This was something that was there for decades, if not close to a century before Katrina. Katrina wiped it out. And it's hopefully a time where things are starting to settle in so we can move forward.
Capital investment doesn't just happen. Somebody's got to be willing to put the money up. But does insurance play a hand in a role in any of that, Joe?
I think insurance will play a role in all of that. Part of it, too, Tommy, like one of the things you sort of alluded to is being over the water. kind of unlikely. You'll have significant structures over the water. It could be possible that some of it is inside the waterway, so you're not sticking out, or if it is, it's a very minor way. Obviously, insurance is a part of it. The interest rates going up are a part of it. Materials becoming more expensive is a part of it. But if you look at the sort of the market analysis that the outside consultant provided, the lakefront area is one that's been growing and has needs. And look, my view is that's good for the lakefront, but this is really supposed to be a city asset too, and one for hopefully Jefferson Parish as well. And so we can get a place where you have people from both parishes and not just the lakefront coming over and kind of having a little destination place to go to.
Counselor, did you say you remembered Fitzgerald's, but you were too young to remember Jaeger's in the 80s? Is that what you said?
I was too young for the Jaeger scene, I think, in the 80s, right? Okay. And Bart's, I was you know, okay. I was still in elementary school. I'm not casting stones at anybody.
No, I understand. Yeah, I was just wondering about that because a little bit of inconsistency in your testimony there. Let me take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about this. I'm going to read from the Joseph Cranny NOLA.com article. New Orleans Mayor LaToya Cantrell leaned on Police Superintendent Aaron Kirkpatrick in an attempt to help a controversial lieutenant shot at a promotion last fall. Actions the Civil Service Commission and a new ruling called an improper violation of city policies. I look at this as a positive thing because Ann Kirkpatrick stood up to the mayor in a way. We'll talk more with Joe Geruso when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. All right, 8:56, 4 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Councilmember Joe Geruso. Let's talk about this. Boy, Joe, you know, just when you think you've heard it all, or LaToya Cantrell, the mayor, and I took this as a positive, and maybe you can tell us a story for a little bit of context, but I took it as a positive that Ann Kirkpatrick didn't kneel and bow down. She kind of handled it very diplomatically, said, okay, I'll pause it, but eventually right prevailed. Thoughts?
Well, I think there's a couple of things there. I mean, number one, I think all of us who are elected, sometimes you want to have your staff tell you, hey, you want to take a step back and do you want to think about this? And then number two, in this instance, also remember, not only did Chief Kirkpatrick, when it was coming to the promotions of different people, have to deal with a couple of issues. Number one, Tommy, is remember, if you don't follow the system, you've really hurt morale internally. Mm-hmm. And I think that was something, irrespective of who the boss is, that you really have to think about what is your culture and how are things going to work. And number two, my understanding is she also said we should pause this and work together with the monitors who are still in place on the consent decree. And while I know there are some consent decree haters out there, this is, again, one of those instances where having guardrails with the monitors slowed things down. People took a deep breath. They went back and sort of investigated what needed to be done. And I think ultimately what happened, if I understand correctly, is they wound up relying on a matrix, which I think to promote people is based both on your scores plus interviews and other criteria. And it's sort of, you mix an objective and a subjective test together to see who are the highest scoring people, considering both of those parameters, and then those are the people who are supposed to be promoted. And so, yeah, I think you have to applaud Chief Kirkpatrick for what she's done and for preaching and looking at things moving in a certain way and trying to do things the right way. And again, I think one of the reasons the rank and file police officers really like Ann is because they feel like she has their back and making sure that there's certainty and discipline, certainty and promotions, predictability in the way things are going to be done is all anybody craves in office culture. I think she's really trying to do that. And my argument would be, that's probably part of the reason you've seen some better results from NOPD, because you see happy campers there.
Man, you're a pretty smart guy. You go to Shaw? Where'd you go to high school?
I went to another Catholic League school. Okay. You know which one that is.
Really? Yeah, it just seemed like that's a pretty smart observation about you do want members of your staff to say, hang on. But without doubt, the mayor shouldn't have been meddling in this at all.
You want to stay away from it. Look, the hard part, Tommy, is I can understand if you are a mayor, you want things to operate the way that you want them to, and you want things to work out the way that you want to. I mean, that is whether anybody wants to admit that or not, I think every mayor and every elected official wants things to go
Joe,
their way.
Come on, Joe.
I know, but that's where I'm headed. But okay. Here comes the but.
All right.
Here comes the but.
Right.
But even though that's the case, you got to be careful and know where you can't put your thumb on the scale and say, we have to have a process, and we're going to let the process lay out. And the other thing, too, Tommy, is even if you are a person who wants to move because you think you know what the right answer is, a lot of times your protection is in process. And following the right process yields to good results. And that's where I think we should all be headed.
Thank you, Joe. .909 as we matriculate our way through this Tuesday morning, April the 15th, which is, I guess you know, tax day. So you got to do whatever you got to do. With that, we just heard a little bit from Jake Madison, host of Locked On Pelicans. He was pretty clear in his opinion. We're going to be joined by him right now, as a matter of fact, to talk about the replacement for David Griffin and the Pelicans. Good morning, Jake. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on to talk some hoops here.
Yeah, let's talk about David Griffin. I met him and spoke with him a couple of times, and he's a very nice man. But let's go back and look at, because you got to figure out where you were and how you got from there to here before you can figure out where you go from here to there, right? So let's talk about David Griffin looking back, talk about his history with the Pelicans and where maybe the failures were. Because, again, I think he's a nice man, but sometimes being nice is not enough, being a nice guy, right?
No, like it's about winning games in the NBA, and I think when you look at the Zion Williamson and David Griffin tenure so far these past 6 years, they just haven't done enough winning and haven't had the type of success that they wanted. And you can point to specific, you know, roster mismanagement moves by David Griffin, holding on to Brandon Ingram too long, not trading him sooner, you know, maybe signing and trading for Devontae Graham and then using 4 second-round picks to get off of that bad contract that they gave him, not acquiring the center that they've needed, or even moving on from Dyson Daniels, who might win Defensive Player of the Year this season. But really the biggest, I think, mistake in David Griffin's tenure, which is what has led the team to this point, was that he didn't get it right with Zion Williamson early. And Zion Williamson came in as an 18-year-old number one overall pick, hyped up beyond belief, but that lacked some of the professionalism that he needed to have and some of the structure around him to kind of become one of those all-time greats and lead this team to the type of success that they wanted. It was evidence that, you know, he wasn't taking the offseason seriously and things like that. And while that's not David Griffin's fault necessarily, you still got to connect with your star player and get their buy-in and put the right type of infrastructure around him. And that was something that the team failed to do early on in Zion's tenure here. And I think that's led to a lot of the missed games from Zion and the lack of success that the team has wanted. And while a lot of that's on Zion and he needs to shoulder that blame, it's still on your lead basketball decision maker to make it work in the first place. And so you could almost say that David Griffin is a bit of a victim of Zion Williamson.
I want to talk about that a little bit more. What could have or should have David Griffin have done? And if nothing, as you said, that he's a victim of Zion Williamson, then does that go to the selection to begin with? Take me through all of that.
Yeah, you know, I think when you look at Zion Williamson, right, like he, when it comes to, say, evaluating coaches in front office, you're judged on results. That's what this is. It's a results-oriented business. You can talk about process and all that, but you're going to be judged by your wins and losses, playoff trips, playoff victories, things like that. And they just haven't had that success here in New Orleans like they wanted. Mm-hmm. But the coach can't make players play. The front office can't make players play. And when you have multiple seasons of Zion Williamson, 3 or 4 of his first 6 years in the league, he's played under 30 games or fewer, you're just not going to win very many games when it's an 82-game season like that if your star players aren't available. We can talk about Zion Williamson's talent, and he has it tremendously. When he played this year, he looked absolutely phenomenal, but it was only 30 games out of 82, and so that's going to lead you to a bad season, I think. That's not directly David Griffin's fault. That's not directly head coach Willie Green's fault, but they have kind of a factor into it too. And one of the things that I have long said is Zion Williamson is so talented that if I were running the team, I'd be willing to go down with the Zion Williamson ship trying to make it work. And ultimately, that's kind of what happened to David Griffin. Rather than trading Zion earlier on in his career, maybe when Zion's value was higher, they stuck with him and trying to build around him. And he just missed too many games, and it's led to bad seasons.
I've spoken with people that know basketball and have coached basketball, and they have this theory out there, and you may have heard it, that, as you mentioned, structure around Zion, that there's something about Zion's structure that they predicted, and I remember when it happened, they predicted that he wasn't going to be a guy that would be able to be available a lot, that he just, the way he was put together physically, wasn't lent to be a long-term NBA player or to put in a lot of court time during the season. Have you heard that, and your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've seen that's been an issue for him. You know, he has regularly not shown up to the beginning of the regular season training camp in kind of the shape that you want him to be in, the conditioning that you want him to be in. And you're seeing him usually throughout the season kind of play himself into game shape. And that's something that's held the team back. You know, when you look at the injuries, particularly these hamstring injuries that he has suffered repeatedly at this point in time, you know, is that due to, you know, dumb luck, or is that due to his lack of preparation or taking care of his body? And no one was expecting him to come in, you know, as an 18, 19 year old to the NBA and doing all the things that LeBron James does and started doing, you know, year 10 in his career, 15, 20, right, where he famously spends $1 million plus every year just taking care of his body so he can be on the court and be available. You know, it took LeBron a number of years to kind of get to that point and get to that level of, like, professionalism. But, you know, we've seen interviews with Zion Williamson in the past where he kind of laughed, like, at stretching and players saying they stretch to keep themselves, you know, loose and avoid injuries. And Zion's kind of laughing, like, why are you doing that? That seems kind of stupid. Mm-hmm. And when we look at it through that kind of lens, did that lead to a lot of the issues that he's had out there on the court? And when these same issues keep repeating themselves over and over and over again, that's where I think we can kind of point to Zion and say, hey, like, it's not roster mismanagement. It's not just coaching that's an issue here in New Orleans. It's Zion, the player, as well. And I even think he'd own up to some of that. And he has in the past. And you saw this year start to look a little bit different from him. And if this team wants to compete in the playoffs next season or build a winner going forward, they're going to need to rely on Zion being the most professional version of Zion. That's still a bit of an open question, even if we've seen incremental improvements trying to get there.
I want to get back to the victim thing, Jake. And what I mean by that is, what ultimately, when it comes to an NBA player and management, I mean, you can't attach somebody to the guy 24/7 during the off season and everything else, make sure he's eating right, doing this, doing that, can you?
No, exactly. And I think one of the things that you've seen the team try and do is try and kind of put in some of that structure, and it's worked and hasn't worked. And look, this job of building a competitive team, particularly around a star player like this, can be really, really difficult. And sometimes it's just as simple as that of, like, the job's hard. You know, they rookie year for Zion Williams, and they brought in someone like J.J. Redick, who had a winning pedigree throughout the NBA, who had played at Duke, so had that connection with Zion Williams. And they brought in Trajan Langdon to be the general manager, a former Duke guy too, hoping that having that connection to him would allow him to learn from those guys, listen to those guys. And they've tried various things to just put leadership around the team to kind of set that example. Trading for C.J. McCollum is a good example of that too. This is the guy who's the head of the NBA Players Association. So he's kind of the consummate professional that you would hope Zion would model himself after. And it just hasn't always stuck with Zion Williamson when it comes to that. And look, they even tried it with the head coach. You know, when Zion was a rookie, they had Alvin Gentry, who's famously a laid-back players coach, not doing a ton of practices, or if they are practicing, it's just a short little quick practice. And they replaced him with more of a disciplinarian in Stan Van Gundy. And that led to Zion Williamson's best season, arguably, in terms of health and play that we've really seen from him before. And that was just his second year in the league. But Stan Van Gundy didn't mesh with Brandon Ingram, who's now no longer on the team, but that created some odds there too. So it was a big puzzle with complex moving pieces that they've just been trying to all fit together and haven't just found the magic components to that sort of thing.
That's a great explanation. And when you go look at the bottom line, you got a 24-year-old that you've already paid $115 million that you have limited control over. So it's really all up to him at this point. Would you not agree?
I think at this point it's on Zion Williamson if the light is going to kind of go off or not. And look, he's going to have a career in the NBA, but if you want to become an all-time great, yeah, exactly, it comes down to winning. And it means winning multiple titles, right? The NBA's rings culture is what we joke about with it, where it's how many titles do you have? That's ultimately sometimes the most important thing. And if he doesn't get one, he's not going to go down as an all-time great. And some people are okay not being an all-time great. Some people are fine just kind of treating the NBA like a job. Let me go out and make as much money as possible, go home, enjoy my offseason with my friends and family. I'll come back the next day and do the job that I kind of need to do. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you want to go down as one of the top players and you have that drive, that desire, it takes more than what we've seen from Zion Williamson so far. And to his credit, I think you saw some of that changing a little bit this season. 30 games because of a hamstring injury, and they shut him down for tanking purposes at the end of the year. But he was competing on defense. That's not something that he's done through his first 5 years until this year. He was actively trying on that side of the ball, and that's where you expend a lot of energy. So if you're looking at a player being lazy, something like that, they don't give it their all on the defensive side of the ball. They're going to save it for trying to score points and kind of putting up those like glory numbers in a sense like that. But Zion was competing on the defensive side of the ball in a lost season for New Orleans. That at least shows that there's something there, and maybe things are turning around for him in the way that you want him to be.
It's time to look in the mirror and say, look, God gave me this size, this ability. I've got all the money I need for the rest of my life. Where do we go from here? What do I want to do from here? If not Willie Green, if not David Griffin, who? He's gone. Who? Who are you looking at? If not Joe Dumars, who?
You know, so the big rumor right now is Joe Dumars being a serious front runner for this job, and it was reported yesterday by ESPN that, look, they might want to try and get this deal done at the end of the week, and I was listening to the show before I came on here, and they played the clip from Sports Talk last night where I said, Joe Dumars would be a lazy hire, and that is not at all what the team should do. Maybe you end up hiring. I'm okay with that, but you need to go through an exhaustive process to find the right person to lead this team. Maybe it's Joe Dumars, maybe it's not, but right now it doesn't seem like the Pelicans are going through a process. They're more or less just going to give this job to Joe Dumars because he's friendly with ownership and people in high-ranking positions within the Saints and Pelicans, and to me it's such an inflection point for this franchise where you need to kind of chart the course for the next 5 to 10 years. You need to get someone with a clear vision and allow that person to go and execute it. And if you're just handing the job to someone because they're kind of a friend, that is not a good process for hiring someone. You want the most qualified person, not someone who just is from the state of Louisiana and they kind of default into the job there. Maybe that's Joe Dumars, maybe it's not, but if they just hand him the job, that is a lazy process and something that would make me massively concerned about the state of this franchise. If you go through all of this and you interview a guy like Calvin Booth, who was just let go by the Denver Nuggets, who built the team that won a title just 2 years ago, or you get someone like Bob Myers, who built up that dynasty of the Golden State Warriors, at least interview those people or try and get interviews with those folks rather than just shoehorning somebody into this position because you like them. And I think that's something that the Pelicans really need to look at. You mentioned introspection and kind of looking yourself in the mirror in terms of Zion Williamson. I think this franchise needs to do the same thing and really understand where they are, what they need to do going forward. Find someone with a clear vision for that. Align everyone from ownership, front office, coaching, players to that vision, and give that person the freedom to go out and execute that vision. I'm worried the Pelicans aren't going to kind of do that, and that makes me worried about the next 5 years with the team, truthfully.
Yeah, you know what? As you say that, it's kind of like Zion as a team in microcosm, where it's like, okay, we're making money now. What do we want to do? How good do we want to be? How far do we want to take this thing? Take me real quick in the time we have left, Jake. From GM on down the line to Willie Green to even Zion and what next year is likely to look like.
You know, it's going to depend on who they hire, or at least it should depend on who they hire. We've heard some rumors that it's going to be Joe Dumars and that ownership is going to force him to keep Willie Green because they like Willie Green. Look, whoever is hired for this, it's Zion Williamson and Willie Green's future should be up to them and them alone to own and make that decision. I think you probably need some fresh blood on the coaching bench. It just hasn't worked under Willie Green. We've seen him kind of fall into some of the same mistakes that he's made over his tenure here. You know, to his credit, he has never lost the locker room. The team has never quit on him, and I think that's a really important thing to look at. The players have a lot of respect for Willie Green, and sometimes that's the most important quality you need in a head coach. But ultimately, that needs to be up to David Griffin's replacement, and that's the process that the Pelicans should follow. Same with Zion Williamson. There's reasons to keep him because of his top-end talent, but look, it's been a roller coaster, and maybe you just want to get off this roller coaster and this maddening ride, because I think a lot of people would say it has not been fun so far. This is sports. It should be entertainment, too. You should have fans enjoying themselves going to games. This season definitely wasn't that, so I think that's why they felt the need to make a change and really shake things up, and maybe there need to be more changes and more shakeups coming.
To hire a GM without giving them control over the coach seems like you're just heading for failure. You're driving a Titanic toward the iceberg.
Absolutely. You look at it with the Memphis Grizzlies and the Denver Nuggets recently, who both fired their head coaches really late in the season in moves that were largely panned to kind of across NBA pundits around the country, right? You need alignment between your front office and your head coach. And when that alignment fails or breaks, and there's nothing to say that David Griffin and Willie Green weren't aligned, but you just have to have that. And if you hire a GM in, and then Willie Green coaches out next season, then the GM fires him to bring in their own guy and get that alignment in a year, you just wasted a year. And there's no reason to do anything like that to save people's feelings or because you have, you know, a strong personal connection to someone. It's about winning in the NBA. You want to build the right kind of culture that is people first with that too, but you still got to win and you got to get results, and you don't want to make short-sighted mistakes that set your franchise back 1, 2, or 3 years or anything like that.
Look, I get it. If you want the money, I understand that side of it. But responsibility without authority never, ever succeeds, ever. Hey, thank you. I appreciate your time. And I hope we talk to you again soon, Jake.
Of course. Thanks for having me on, Tommy.
You bet. Jake Madison, host of Locked On Pelicans. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out. And also interesting to look at it as, you know, Zion looking at himself in the mirror and the franchise looking at themselves in the mirror like, okay, we have this. We're making this. Now, how far do we want to go? 9:24, we'll take a break, come back, talk to Dr. Judy Ho, our friend, licensed clinical forensic neuropsychologist, about 9:31, 29 till 10. Interesting conversation with Jake Madison, host of Locked On Podcast. Now, keep in mind, everything with the Pelicans, we don't know what we don't know. We don't know who the Pelicans are talking to, who they're not talking to, who they were talking to before. Because I guarantee you, any organization that's worth its salt, you don't just make a move and not have thoughts, preliminary conversations with who your next person's going to be. It just never happens. I got people lined up waiting for my job right now, I can guarantee you that. Tim, you haven't heard anything, have you? Good. Hey, you ready to go to a party? Now's your chance to win a pair of tickets to the second weekend of Jazz Fest. Today's password is crawfish. Crawfish. Go to WWL.com/contest. Register to win. It's that easy. Don't miss your chance to win. All you have to do is listen at 9 o'clock, noon, 3, and 6 for the Jazz Fest code word of the day to see amazing artists like Pearl Jam, Dave Matthews Band, John Fogerty, Lil Wayne and the Roots, Casey Musgrave, Harry Connick Jr., and more. Good luck. Happy festing from Miller Lite, the official beer of Jazz Fest and WWL. We're getting ready to talk about mental health with Dr. Judy O, our friend, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Good morning, Dr. Judy. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right. Let me get to this quickly. Somebody texted and said, we're going to talk about Kyron Lacey, and somebody texted and said, I didn't hear anyone talking about the person he killed and their family. Well, I'm going to tell you the whole story right now, and it goes back to an accident that happened in December where Kyron Lacey was traveling on Highway 20 very fast in a designated no-passing zone. Witnesses say he was recklessly passing multiple vehicles at a high rate of speed, crossing the center line, and he killed somebody in a collision. And as a result, he fled the scene. So nobody knows what condition he was in when he was driving, and I'm not going to speculate on that. But he was booked with negligent homicide. So fast forward to earlier this weekend when he was involved in a domestic incident. I'll let it go at that. And then that led to a police chase. And in the course of the chase, he pulled out a gun and shot himself in the head. And is a guy with all the talent in the world, a bright future ahead of him. I'm going down before the negligent homicide arrest. And now all of a sudden, it's all gone. And his parents took to social media and said, you got to, I'm going to read this here. Young parents, start talking to your kids at a very early age and make sure they are confident and comfortable confiding in you. Don't be cool with I'm all right or I'm good when you know deep down something isn't right. Mental health is real, and for the most part, it's invisible. Don't ignore the signs, even if they may seem small. So we're not in any way discounting the person whose life was lost with the reckless driving. But I will say this, I have already made in my life bad decisions when I was an older person driving too fast that could have easily led to something like that. I have already driven under the influence younger in my life when I shouldn't have. That, but for the grace of God, could have led to me getting in trouble. And I would just ask, before we start judging Kyron Lacey too harshly, and again, somebody lost their life with his reckless driving. I understand that. But we've all made bad decisions in our lives but for the grace of God that could have turned otherwise. So, Dr. Judy, I guess I'll start with you. With parenting and young people and their minds the way they work, we don't think, or people when they're younger, our minds are not wired up as they are when we're 60. Are we?
No, we're not. Actually, it's very tragic on so many fronts. Obviously, the person that Kyron Lacy killed in this accident you just described, very, very sad for him and his family. And it's also very sad that Kyron Lacy died of an apparent suicide. And I think one of the things that we know about the human brain is it doesn't fully form until basically your early 30s. That's the average. So when somebody is a teenager, a young adult, all the way into their 20s and into their late 20s, their brain is still under construction, and particularly the frontal lobe. So the frontal lobe is responsible for executive functions. This is what makes us uniquely human, like being able to plan ahead, problem solve, go into new situations and know what to do, multitask when we need to, follow sequential instructions, and really importantly, impulse control, right? So think back to when you were a kid or when you were a young adult, and maybe you get into an argument with somebody and you're just ready to scream back at them, maybe even let fists fly. Now, fast forward your 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, you might still have an internal inclination to want to do that when somebody is rude to you, but you hold back. You do something different, right? Because our brains are able to say, well, let's control this impulse, which isn't going to lead to anything good, and let's take another course of action instead that makes sense and still allows me to have my dignity. So that's just one example of one of the most important things that your brain does not really know how to do well until you're about 30 years old.
So some people even struggle with impulse control beyond that, don't they?
Absolutely. And so there's some people who have more clinical problems, I'll say, with impulse control. And that can happen essentially at any age, right? But on the average, people's impulse control improves. And so at the very most, your brain is at least fully formed. But of course, there are personality differences. There's people with actual clinical problems with anger for different reasons that could cause impulse control to be a problem, or perhaps attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. That is the impulsive hyperactive type. So those individuals, their brains just work differently from the average person, so that even once you're past the quote unquote maturation age, you're still struggling with some of those issues, but for different reasons.
So I'm very empathetic and sympathetic to this whole situation for so many different reasons as a parent. This young man had just gifts that few people have. It was destined for a career in the NFL, had a brilliant college career, and now it's all gone. His parents are without a child. Somebody is dead. A 74-year-old person is dead as a result of reckless driving due to a bad decision. And I guess what makes me so sympathetic and empathetic is that, Dr. Judy, I have made some very bad decisions in my life that could have gone the other way. So I don't know really how to ask this question other than a lot of us don't realize how lucky we are before we judge other people when it comes to bad decisions.
Right. Well, I think, you know, sometimes
it's hard to put that in a data context, but, you know.
Right. Well, it's tough because what's behind judgment oftentimes is a couple of things, right? One is just when something's out of your control, like hearing about these tragedies that have happened, tragedies, plural, you can't do anything about it. They've already happened, right? And so sometimes judging people is a way of us to try to feel like there's some sense of control that we have, right, over something that's so sad and so needless. And when you judge somebody, it's like it's an action, right? You're making a decision to make an opinion about somebody. And that gives you a sense of empowerment when really, truly in these situations, we don't have any power, sadly. The other thing is sometimes judging people, and I think that this happens subconsciously, we're not doing it on purpose all the time, makes you feel better about yourself. Like, well, I would never do something like that. How dare this person? You know, and it's weird, but it maybe in a weird way, it's a little bit of a self-esteem boost when we judge other people's bad behaviors. But what we really should know is that you never know what somebody is dealing with on the inside, what they're struggling with, you know, whether or not overall they were a kind, empathetic person and they just made some terrible decisions that cost people's lives, clearly. Mm. But it's still on the backdrop of perhaps this was still a person that was a lovely person that was redeemable and clearly was loved by his family and friends who are grieving him right now. We don't have all the information and we're probably never going to get it, right? I have had friends who have died by suicide, Tommy. And, you know, among our friend circle, we try to talk about it and we say, well, maybe it's because they were going through this thing or that thing. But you know what? We won't ever know. We won't ever know why they chose to do it. It's easy to say, oh, maybe they had problems in their relationship or maybe they had problems with their job. But a lot of people have problems with their relationship and their job and they don't take their own lives. And so I don't think you're ever going to get a satisfying answer.
It's just, I guess this really just for some reason touched me, Dr. Judy, because I watched him play and it just is such a sad situation. And including the person whose life was lost by just driving on a highway and somebody doing something stupid in a car, driving too fast. And Lord knows we see that every day on the highways. Let me take a break. We'll talk about parents and mental health with their kids when we come back. Dr. Judy Ho, our friend, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. 941 Traffic Now, WWL. It is 9:46, 14 till 9. Every other Tuesday, we talk about mental health and focus on it. Dr. Judy Ho, our friend, our guest, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, a mom herself, author of numerous books. And we thought with the tragedy involving Kyron Lacey, both from the victim, the person that he killed on a highway with reckless driving, and I don't know what he hit and run and took off after the accident, so nobody knows what condition he was in, but he was facing negligent homicide charges. Then in Houston, after a domestic incident where he fired a gun during a police chase, put the gun to his head and killed himself. And his parents took to social media and said, young parents, start talking to your kids at a very early age. Make sure they're confident and comfortable confiding in you. That was what Kenny Lacey said. Now, obviously, this young man was in a heap of trouble with the negligent homicide charge. But at some point, Dr. Judy, and going to the point of, and one thing I tried to do as a parent is, you know, you can always talk about punishment later and everything else. But the typical example of if you're in high school and you go out and you get drunk, call me. If you feel unsafe, call me. I am the safe place. I am the one you can count on. And then we'll deal with the rest of it later. How important is it that parents get that message to their kids?
Really important, because obviously, you know, you have to expect that your child is going to make some mistake at some point in their life. And you want them to be able to come to you, to confide in you, to consult with you. And like you said, at some point we'll talk about the consequences. But first of all, let's deal with this present situation. They need to know that even if you are going to have boundaries, even if you are going to talk about discipline, that the very first thing is knowing that they can trust you no matter what happens.
We'll get through it. We'll deal with it no matter what. There are going to be consequences, but we'll get through it. The most important thing is to take yourself out of the threatening situation or doing harm to yourself or whatever it happens to be. What are some maybe warning signs or what age groups that parents can really start looking out for when it comes to their kids? And going back to what Kenny Lacey said about his late son, that don't just accept, I'm all right or I'm good, when you know deep down something isn't right. How does a parent get past that? No, everything's good, everything's great, when they know it really isn't.
Right. Yeah, it's hard because sometimes you're saying, okay, I'm not going to keep crying. They're already saying it's fine. I'm going to leave it alone. You know, I feel like we have talked about this before, in that parental monitoring is the number one thing that helps your child and your growing child as they grow into adulthood on a positive trajectory, both in terms of school and in terms of relationships, as well as how they do in their jobs and just general adulting skills. I mean, it's related to so many different things. And parental monitoring, very simply defined, just means you know what your kid is up to and you're always asking them questions to know about their life and how they're doing.
that's really what parental monitoring is. And so obviously, as they get to a certain age, they're going to push back a bit. They're going to say you're annoying. They may even use other choice words or get kind of aggressive with you. But you can't let up on that quest, essentially. Like, well, you're still going to have to tell me. If you want to keep your phone with you, as long as you're in my house, I need to know who you're calling. I need to know who you're going to be with tonight. I need to see your social media. You know, you can't give up on trying to know all you can about them and their life, especially as they're growing. Even if they push back, and even if they just say, ah, sure, I'm fine, just leave me alone. And also, even when things seem okay, because people who tend to, sadly, commit suicide, for example, or even have suicidal thoughts, they tend to be the ones that are going to say, yeah, I'm okay, and just kind of walk away. They're not going to necessarily act out all the time. They're kind of more internalized in terms of their suffering. And so sometimes the more quiet ones, you have to try to draw out even more for that reason.
Dr. Judy, we only have a couple of minutes left, and I do want to get to this. I'm a lot farther down the parenting road than are you, but you're a licensed clinical neuropsychologist. Sometimes parents, when the kids get to be 28 in the 30s, you don't know what to do because you want to help, but sometimes you just got to back off and butt out and let them figure it out for themselves and stop. Yeah, I don't know. Take me through that. How do you make sure everything's all right without really inserting yourself too much into it or butting in too much?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think it's a learning process as you go through parenthood. You know, you know your child best. You know their personality, and you know what they're going to need and not need. And sometimes you have to know that it's about your own insecurities, maybe things that have happened to you when you were younger, why you're being so overprotective. So I think that a good check is just, you know, do I feel that I know enough about what's going on with them? And do I feel like I've had the opportunity to teach them as much as I can about this situation? And once you have, you do have to just let them navigate it as well, right? But I think that the key is just asking questions and staying engaged. Like, you can let them navigate it, but after the situation, you can talk about it. You can ask them questions. You can try to impart some life lessons. But it's not about, you know, following them wherever they're going, right? You know that it's going to be overboard if you're just constantly so on them that they can't develop their own life skills. And so you have to have that balance of letting them try things out on their own, but always talking to them about it, processing it with them, and interjecting life lessons wherever you can.
As a licensed clinical and forensic neuropsychologist and a mom, would you agree with me when I say, for any people out there that are considering having kids, buckle up?
Yeah, buckle up.
Yeah.
Exactly. I love that.
Buckle up.
Very, very true.
Get ready.
Very true.
Buckle up. Thank you, Dr. Get Judy. Ready. A pleasure as always. Tell Luca hi for us.
Well, thanks, Tommy. Great
bet.
Talking to you.
The same as always. That's not professional advice, but buckle up. 9:53, 7 till 10. We'll find out what Noel's got planned for us when we come back on this Tuesday morning here on WWL.